My paper is a dialogue between two contemporary ideas that are having a profound impact on our world. On the one hand, we have sense arguments that you already heard about, development as freedom. And on the other hand, we have the research of the last 40 years on economics of happiness. Now, we will see that when those two ideas come in contact, a conflict arises. There seems to be a tension between the idea of freedoms as the primary means and the end of development and economics of happiness or well-being. Now, if we perceive dialogue following Gadamer's world, that is about broadening the horizons, what I will argue in this paper is that we have two ideas whose horizon is touching each other. It creates a conflict, and through dialogue, we can create something in the area of conflict. Now, my story starts in 2001, not 2001 years ago, like most other speakers. 2001 was the time when a very important idea from economics and finance mutated. It was the idea of a mortgage-backed security. Many young people in the audience who would like to own a home, they are asked by the banks to put down a deposit to buy the house of a much higher value that they can pay for, but then they use their monthly income to pay for the mortgage loan. Now, if you don't have a rich father or a ship owner grandfather to help you put the down payment, modern finance provided the tools for expanding the freedoms of this group of wage earners. And that was the idea of a mortgage-backed security. You pull a group of loans into a synthetic financial instrument, you use advanced mathematics to price it, and you sell it to a pension fund. So you don't really go to your grandfather, but you go to an institutional grandfather, the pension fund. The pension fund will give you the money to buy the mortgage in this group of homeowners, and in exchange, this group of homeowners will make monthly payments to the pension fund, essentially paying for their retirement. Now, this was a brilliant idea, and when it was established several years ago, it helped fuel the growth of the mortgage market in the United States and in many other European countries very successfully. But what happened in about 2001? 2001, bankers discovered that they have sold mortgages to about anybody who could afford them, so they started offering loans to people who could not afford them. This went under the name of ninja loans. Now, ninja is not the mutated ninja turtle. Ninja stands for no income, no job, no assets. So the bankers started offering loans to people who had no income, no job, no assets. Now, why could they do that? Now, why should they do that? They should do that because they were earning the fee of initiating a loan. Now, anybody in the room with a medium understanding of banking will say, but what if the loan defaults? Doesn't the banker run the risk of losing their money? That's where the brilliant idea of securitization went wrong. The bankers had packaged and repackaged and repackaged the loans using advanced mathematics to price them, and then they would sell them to unsuspecting investors, like banks in Iceland. So the bankers were sitting in the middle, giving loans to no income, no job, no assets borrowers, selling the result to unsuspecting investors in Iceland or other parts of the world, and they were reaping the profits. And of course, we all know what happened in 2007, the crisis. Everybody talks about the crisis of 2008, but the crisis started about 2007. The ninja loans fueled a bubble in the mortgage market. This is the index, the blue and the red line that you see there. But then at some point, the bubble burst. And the bubble burst, and a very simple calculation, the dotted line, shows that if things had gone, if the mortgage products had not mutated, they would have fallen the green line to a sustainable level of the mortgage market. But instead, this expanded freedoms of investment went wrong. We had the bubble, we had the burst of the bubble, and the ensuing worldwide financial crisis. Data show that between 2001 and 2006, there were 600 billion subprime loans, ninja kind of loans, and between 2007 and 2008, 560 billion of these loans were written off. Now, one of the speakers yesterday made the comment that I believe was Professor Barrow, that derivatives and mathematics, you could use mathematics to price derivatives, but this example shows that things are much more complex. We had the interaction of the mathematics of the financial instruments with the incentive and compensation schemes of chief executive officers of the banks. It was not a question of mathematics. It was a complex interaction. I'm not going to follow that path in the paper, although that was an interesting point, but I will follow another path. We had introduced products that enhance our freedoms and our capabilities to own a home. So this was in favor of Amartya Sen's development as freedom. But this increased freedom of transaction did not bring increased happiness. So starting from this observation of something I know very well, I was part of the mathematicians that started the mortgage market many years ago, I asked myself the question, what went wrong? So is there a flaw in the famous argument that freedoms are both the primary ends and the principal means of development? I should answer immediately that no, that something else went wrong to violate freedoms. There were no transparency guarantees in the process, but asking the question, we will learn some very interesting lessons. Of course, so my objective is to link the notion of freedom as the primary end and the principal means of development with the findings of research on the economics of happiness. Now, it's worth pointing out that this link was made somewhat tentatively in the famous treatise by John Stuart Mill on liberty, where he developed a chapter on individuality. So when one of the speakers yesterday or day before attacked individuality, that was in a sense an indirect attack on liberties. But Jeremy Bentham had articulated the opinion that liberty is a good that, even though it's not of fundamental value, reflects the greatest happiness principle. That is, freedom produces the greatest amount of happiness for the greatest number of people. Now, this is the wisdom I'm questioning in the paper. So the summary of my arguments are as follows. First, freedom as the main end and the primary means of development, the expansion of instrumental freedoms enhance the ability of individuals to act as free agents. So freedom is good. Second point, people cannot always choose what makes them happy in the long run. Second point. My third point, I will provide some evidence against freedom. To go to my fourth point, what needs to be done? What needs to be done so that without curtailing freedoms, we pursue the greatest happiness principle? And there is a fifth part in the paper which Mr. Chairman of the conference has been left blank, and I'm glad to report that after listening to the talk for the last few days, I can fill it in. The last part is, what does Greek classical thought have to tell us about this problem? Now, why are these issues of increased relevance today? For three reasons. First of all, the prevailing political model of liberal democracy and free markets has improved people's consumers' ability to exercise their freedoms. Not only that, but the technique of marketing is pushing us to exercise our freedoms, to consume more. At the same time, technology has empowered the individual as a free agent. A good example is Jody Williams, the Nobel Prize winner, for her work on anti-personnel mines. When she was asked how did she manage to bring together 1,000 NGOs for the fight against personnel mines, her reply was one word, email. The third reason why this topic is important is because, at least in the developed world, over the last hundreds of years, modern economies, as a result of automation, have been able to satisfy our basic needs, Abraham Maslow's hierarchy, physiological needs and safety needs are adequately satisfied. So we're moving up on the Maslow hierarchy of needs, trying to satisfy esteem. I believe this is where Professor Ober left his dignity argument, or higher up on self-actualization. Okay, so first on the freedom side, what did Amartya Sen tell us? Amartya Sen tells us that development is a process of expanding the real freedoms that people enjoy. Other speakers already made the point today. It is not about the growth of GDP or GNP, but it's the ability of people to exercise, to expand their freedoms and exercise their capabilities. GNP is but a means to an end. Amartya Sen is asking, what good is GNP if we do not have access to education or health or the freedom to participate in public discussion? On the other side of the argument, freedom is the principal means of development, and that's the part that's relevant to my work. Freedoms allow people to enhance their capabilities and their effectiveness in acting as free agents. Freedoms also have a multiplier effect. The multiple kind of freedoms, where they are exercised, they reinforce on each other. And the key instrumental freedoms, as Sen points them out, is political freedom, economic facilities, the one I'm interested in, social opportunities, transparency guarantees, and protective security. For those non-economists in the market, in the audience, I want to make the point that economic facilities and the role of the markets goes beyond just economic growth. It affords people the freedom of transaction and the freedom of exchange. It's through the markets that people's ability to trade their labor has been enhanced and the freedom to participate in the labor market. On the happiness side of the equation now, of course, happiness is an old world. We heard about Aristotle, Eudaimonia and Makariotita. Buddha, in his earliest work, talks about if one speaks or acts with a pure thought, happiness follows one like a shadow that never leaves. Now, I want to point out I have not studied Buddha, but I have studied a very interesting book by historian McMahon, A History of Happiness. But it was not until the Enlightenment and the 18th century that Jeremy Bentham developed Felicific Calculus, an algorithm that allows us to calculate the amount of pleasure a specific action is likely to cause. And therefore, happiness moved from the abstract realm of philosophical ideas to the pragmatic domain of policy making. And following writings of political philosophers of the Benthamite school, we have in the Declaration of Independence, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness as among the unalienable rights. And the French Constitution of 1793 declares the goal of society to be general happiness. So happiness became a constitutional right and the government's obligation to guarantee. Now, what does research on happiness tell us over the last 40 years? Now, I have to point out here, to avoid long discussions later on semantics, people, researchers, use the word happiness, well-being, or life satisfaction in an interchangeable fashion. And the first question is, can happiness or well-being be measured? Now, here there seems to be a consensus between psychologists, social and political scientists, and later economists, that there are reliable and valid measures of happiness. And research over the last 40 years has found many interesting statistics. For example, our happiness with age follows a U-shaped curve, like we become less happy until our 30s, but after our 30s, our happiness tends to go up well into old age. Married people tend to be happier than unmarried people. Divorce causes unhappiness for 3 years before, but after, most people bounce back. And children do not appear to be causing any significant increase in happiness. Okay. Now, okay. Although I disagree with the last statement, but it's okay. Now, this is an interesting table that will come to it later on. Is the effect of specific activities on happiness. How much time do people spend on different activities, and what is the effect on their happiness? And you see on top of the scale is intimate relations, socializing after work. Remember these two. The middle of the scale is watching TV, and the bottom of the scale is commuting to work or working. Okay, and here is where things are now getting interesting. A study by Professor Easterlin, 1974, who studied time series of happiness level in the United States from 1946, he concluded that higher income was not systematically accompanied by greater happiness. So this spurred some activity, some discussion, or how come we're expanding people's economic facilities and we do not make them happy? This work has been criticized, inconsistency of data, methodological approaches, but anyway you seem to be approaching it, the case seemed to be that there is some confusion. Does higher income lead to happiness or not? Professor Milanovic talk earlier on was relevant in this respect. Data showed that you are happier if you belong in a richer country. Okay, this may be obvious. But at the same time, analysis has shown that if your country is becoming richer across time, you are not becoming any happier. And here is where the contradiction begins. So I'm going to offer some evidence that expanding our economic freedoms does not lead to happiness. The first evidence, if you act as a jury, is coming from Professor Oswald's analysis of data from 1972 to 1998 in the United States and the United Kingdom. They found that while the average population has not really gotten happier or unhappier with growth in income, the subgroup of women saw their happiness level significantly declining. So over the period of testing, the percentage of American women that consider themselves, these are self-reported measures, as happy has dropped, and the same evidence holds for UK data. And this was during the time when, as the authors pointed out, whatever the consequences of anti-female discrimination policy elsewhere in society, it has apparently not been successful in either country in creating a feeling of rising well-being among women. The second evidence, we look at statistics of the
Excuse
consumption.
Excuse me, about the time, keep a little bit of
okay.
The time.
Two minutes, yes. I thought I had 15 minutes, so. Okay, so the testing of the use of drugs, we found that wealthier countries have significantly higher use of hard drugs than not wealthy countries. Argument number three, and I go to this table. Over the period 1965 to 2003, there was a significant increase in free time, about 8 hours for men, 7 hours for women. And where do you think people spend this increased time? You would assume socializing with friends, intimate relations. No. They spend the increased time, free time, watching television, increased by 7 hours per week, while they decrease the time they socialize with friends. Now, when I read this, I moved my television on the second floor. And as a result, now to socialize with my family, I have to move to the second floor. Okay, so what needs to be done? I have more arguments in the paper where you see this conflict, and there is also a theorem by Amartya Sen that Professor Ober also pointed out. You cannot simultaneously optimize liberty and happiness. So what needs to be done? How do we resolve the conflict between the two? And I'm concluding, Mr. Chairman. One answer is education, which is also following from the Paretian liberal argument. Education that is broad enough to allow individuals to judge the impact of their free choices on their happiness. And the analysis of Oswald shows that education is having a positive impact on happiness even when you adjust for income. So education not only makes you wealthier, but even if you adjust for income, it still makes you happier. The second point is the need for metrics that go beyond the traditional metrics of economic growth. And there is a report by Joseph Stiglitz and Amartya Sen on why GDP does not add up. And finally, and this may be my contribution to the Athens dialogue, let's learn from the example of our societies when we realize that on our own free will, we are destroying the environment. What did we do? We start developing regulations and we start developing audits to see the impact of our choices on the environment. So I would argue that we need to develop as society collectively well-being audits, which perhaps is the wisdom of society that Professor Zizioulas was talking about. So in conclusion, if there were some mathematicians of classical education in the framers of the Declaration of Independence, it might have read something like this. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness and its higher moments. This may not be as beautiful, but this would lead to a more just and more sustainable society. Thank you very much.